Welcome to Linguistic Voices on Campus, a podcast series produced at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This series deals with common beliefs about language. Linguistic experts will discuss these beliefs through the lens of their own research. My name is Anja Wanner. I'm a professor of English here at UW-Madison, and today I will discuss a topic that many people have very strong opinions about, dialects of American English. My guest is Dr. Joan Hall, the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, also known as DARE. DARE has been described as the most exciting linguistic project going on in the United States and as one of the glories of contemporary American scholarship. I hope today we will learn something about what makes DARE so unique. Welcome, Dr. Hall.
Thank you.
Dr. Hall, many people think that dialects are not proper speech, and they find it hard to imagine that they are the object of serious linguistic inquiry. What's your take on that?
Well, many people believe that dialects are only spoken by people in the hollows of Appalachia or on islands off the coast or in very isolated parts of the country. But by definition, everybody speaks a dialect, for a dialect is simply a variety of speech that varies in terms of vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation from any other variety of speech. Of course, if you think that your own speech is dialect-free, then it's kind of hard to adjust to that. But we all do speak dialects, and it's fascinating to try to discover the differences in American regional dialects. People in Wisconsin, I think, like to think that their speech is relatively accent-free, but they're surprised often to find that people come here and find words that they don't know. I remember coming here in 1975 and seeing a sign above the Union that said, I thought, brats on the terrace.
Oh, yeah.
My colleagues couldn't understand that I had never heard of a brat. But there are lots of other vocabulary items that are, if not unique to Wisconsin, at least characteristic of Wisconsin. Things such as bakery for the pastries rather than the building where they're made. The term pickle for a cucumber before it has gone into the brine, and things like flowages. Flowages are not found elsewhere. It's a very Wisconsin word. The term golden birthday is one I had never heard, and while it can be heard in the UP and in eastern Minnesota and eastern Iowa, it's still a very Wisconsin thing. Plus some grammatical things, such as, will you pass me that paperclip once? Hey, I'd be happy to do it three or four times. Or using the term yet, where I would use still. Are you using it yet?
That sounds very German to me. So we can see the immigrant influence in Wisconsin English?
Yes, very much. Immigrant influence is also found in names for food items, things like kringle, a Danish pastry found in Racine, or the Norwegian lutefisk and lefse and Swedish limpa, and all sorts of ethnic foods still are well-known here where they're not known elsewhere because, of course, of the large numbers of immigrants from those countries.
So would you say that that's one of the main sources of dialects, immigrant languages? Because as nice as it may be to have all these dialects, wouldn't it be easier to communicate if we all just had the same word for the same thing?
Oh, maybe it would be easier, but it certainly would be much less exciting. I think it would be the same as if we were all to wear black suits all the time and not have any color. The dialects of American English are extraordinarily interesting, I think, and a lot of fun. But yes, I think it's true that the sources of the early settlers are probably the most important influence in determining dialect differences. On the East Coast, the dialect differences are very much more pronounced, because the people who came there earliest came from different parts of England. And for a long time, those communities were very separate from one another. And as other immigrants came later from different places, they brought their own dialects and their own languages. And those, of course, affected the way they learned to speak English. But over time, as people moved west, they tended to move in parallel bands from their East Coast settlements westward. So Northern English or Northern American dialects, New England dialects, tended to spread west across upstate New York and through the upper Midwest to the West Coast, whereas Philadelphia dialects spread west through Pennsylvania and then through the southern parts of Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, And dialects from Charleston and Savannah tended to go south along the Gulf Coast. So those three very broad bands contributed a lot to the spread of distinct dialects in this country. But as people went further and further west, those patterns tended to merge. And the result is that as you get to the far west coast, there are very many fewer dialect differences to characterize those places.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on your website that you are actively looking for new words that you may want to include in the dictionary, and that you ask speakers and readers how they would call a certain thing. So, for example, you ask them how they call the strip of grass between the sidewalk and the curb, if they call it boulevard or parking strip or parkway or terrace. Do you have any other examples or any favorite examples that illustrate how people refer to the same thing by using very different words that don't seem to be related at all?
Yeah, well, the one that everybody knows about is words for a submarine sandwich. Hoagie, for instance, is very characteristic of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but that has spread to surrounding states and is probably growing. Hero is still pretty much confined to New York City. Grinder is a very nice New England term for that. And in Florida, it's called a Cuban. There are other terms, too, like a poor boy or a torpedo. Mm-hmm. But those are pretty well known. We have lots and lots of others that are less well known. One of my favorites is the names for tennis shoes. Sneakers, for instance, is pretty widespread, but you don't hear it very much in the West. In the West, instead, you're likely to hear tennies, or tenny pumps in the South, or tenny runners in the West, especially the Northwest. In the Gulf states, you're likely to hear easy walkers. Mm-hmm. And in the northeastern part of the U.S., you're likely to hear sneaks. So that's a nice collection of regional synonyms. Another good group that is quite varied is the names for a potluck dinner. Potluck is pretty widespread, but it's not as common in the South as it is elsewhere. But in places like Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, it's called a carry-in dinner. Mm-hmm. In Indiana and Montana, a strange bifurcation of regions, it's called a pitch-in. In the South, it's a covered dish dinner. And in northern Illinois, a very small region, it's called a scramble.
Okay, so if anyone ever invites me to a scramble, now I know what it means. The place I would normally look up what these words mean, if I have that, some of them have a ring of regionalism about them, is DARE. I would go to look them up in the DARE dictionary. Can you tell us a little bit more about the dictionary?
Yes, the intent of the dictionary is to record as many as possible of the items of vocabulary, grammar, pronunciation, even bits of syntax, if they vary from one place to another. So for DARE, a region can be as small as a part of a city or as large as almost all of the United States, as long as this particular item is not found everywhere. And we are a historical dictionary, so the intent is not just to talk about the way the words are used now, but to give an individual history of each word with the earliest known citation that we can find, and then as many other examples of usage up through time. But the unique thing about DARE is that we performed a very widespread project of fieldwork between 1965 and 70, where we interviewed people in 1,002 communities across the United States, asking them all the exact same questions in a huge questionnaire. And this questionnaire had questions about time and weather and furniture and farming and money and religion and health and disease and flowers and fishing and transportation, you name it. About 1,800 questions. So we have a...
It must have taken a long time to have these interviews.
Yes. If one person alone did the whole questionnaire, it could take most of a week. So sometimes in a particular community, the field worker had to find several people who were willing to do parts of it. One person might say, well, I'm happy to answer the questions about health and disease and school and money and stuff, but I don't know anything about hunting and fishing, so you'll have to talk to Mr. Jones down the road. And so often, three or four people did contribute to a questionnaire. But the important thing was that every one of those people had been born and raised in that community. And so they were considered to be really representative examples of the particular speech of that area.
Were you one of the field workers?
I was not for DARE. I did field work in rural southeast Georgia on a smaller but very similar project. So I do know what it was like to have to go to a community cold and find people who had lived there all their lives and who met your other criteria and who were willing to give you some time.
Yeah, I would imagine that that's not very easy if you walk into a village with your recording devices and ask for their time.
Right. The easiest thing to do right at first was to find someone who was well established in the community and not ask that person to help you with the interviews, but ask that person to suggest people who had lived there and who were willing to talk and who enjoyed interacting with people. And because our field work was done between 1965 and 70, when there was a lot of turmoil in this country, our field workers often found that it was important to check in with the local police station or sheriff's office first, just to establish their credibility, so they would have some support if anybody thought that they were outlopers.
Linguistic field work can be dangerous. And who are the users of DARE? Do you think that it's mainly used in libraries by linguists and students, or do you think there are other users as well?
We had originally assumed that libraries would be the primary purchasers, and certainly libraries are very great users of DARE. But we've been absolutely delighted to learn about some other uses. And it's also fun to realize how many people simply love language. So they buy DARE, and they simply browse and enjoy the quotations, enjoy
the... I know what that feels like.
The funny words. But some of the uses that I've found to be particularly interesting are use by physicians, for example, because if you grow up here in Madison and go to med school here, and then you're posted for your first job in rural southern Maine or Appalachia or New Mexico, there will be folk names for diseases that you've never heard. Mm-hmm. So if your patient says, "Doc, I've got the ground itch, I've got dew poison, I've got kernels, leaders, pones, I've got pip jennies," what do you say? If you have DARE, you can go look up these words and then know at least what kinds of questions to ask next. So it's a wonderful use that we hadn't anticipated. But it's also been shown to be very useful to forensic linguists. And my favorite example has to do with a case in Ohio where a child was abducted, and the person who did this left a note with the parents. And one of the lines in the note said, "Leave $10,000 in the trash can on the Devil Strip."
On the Devil Strip?
On the Devil Strip. Well, where can you find that? It's not in the OED. It's not in Webster's Third. It's not in the Dictionary of Americanisms. It's not in Random House or any contemporary dictionary. But it is in DARE. The Devil Strip is that strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street that you
the
were
terrace.
Mentioning earlier. Yes. And what's really interesting is that the Devil Strip is a term that's used in a very restricted area in the triangle outlined by Youngstown, Cleveland, and Akron, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, one of the people on the suspect list was from Akron. And when this bit of linguistic evidence was used with the other forensic evidence, the person confessed.
Must have felt very good to contribute to that.
It certainly
solving
did.
That case.
Yeah.
I also heard that sometimes writers who write a novel that is set in a specific region of the United States would consult with DARE to see what kind of language they should use.
Yes, because often it's fairly easy to determine when a word came into the language. And if you have a character using it 30 years before there's any documentation for it, probably that's not quite legitimate. So the fact that we use dated quotations and give regions for our quotations gives writers a huge step up in terms of knowing what words were appropriate and what words would not be appropriate.
You have just given us a picture of how interesting dialects can be and of how useful it also can be for everyday life to study them. But some people are concerned that in this age of globalization and of mass media, dialects are very much a thing of the past and that dialects are becoming more and more homogenized. How do you feel about that?
Well, that's certainly a popular conception, but I'm pleased to say that I think it's a very strong misconception. Yes, language changes. That's the nature of language, to change over time. And one of the things that sometimes happens is that nationwide terms can push out some of the local terms. And I think that's regrettable, but I do recognize that it happens. But it doesn't mean that we're becoming homogenized, because just as local terms can fade out, new local terms can come into existence. One of my favorites is a word that I think is fun to say. The word is skeevy. Ugh, that apartment was so skeevy, I just couldn't imagine renting it. Or, it was so dirty, it just skeeved me out.
Oh, I like that it's an adjective, and then you can also use it as a verb. Very versatile.
Yes, both a passive and active verb. That skeeves me. And it turns out that this is from Italian scafari, and it's used in parts of the U.S. where there is a strong Italian population. New York City, Connecticut, northern New Jersey. It's a very nice regionalism that is relatively new. Now, in terms of language change, new can be 30 or 40 years, and as far as we know, that's been coming on in the last 30 or so years. But there are other things that we've noticed, too. Some of your listeners may know the term story, used to mean a TV soap opera. Now, I have to go home and see my story.
Uh-huh, I never heard that.
We've noticed that the word stobby, which is a nice old English dialect word that has been used to mean rough or uneven or bristly in reference to shrubbery, for instance, a mm-hmm. bristly shrub, seems, according to Google searches, to be used these days by young women to mean something like rude or uncouth or unkind. So this notion of bristly and rough has been transferred from a shrub to a person.
More metaphorical.
Yeah, and this kind of thing happens all the time, and it's fascinating to watch.
You just mentioned Google, so is the internet very helpful for you in finding new regionalisms or even old uses that perhaps you haven't recorded so far?
The internet has been extremely useful. My favorite example when I talk to people about this is that in Volume 4, we had the word scrid, S-C-R-I-D, which means a fragment, a little piece of something. This is an old dialect word, and it has traditionally been a New England word. We had, three or four examples, all from New England, and they were enough to make a decent entry. But when we had access to a number of internet sources, including one called The Making of America, which is a historical site at the University of Michigan and Cornell, where they've digitized 19th century literature, we checked there just to see whether we could find some older sites. And sure enough, we found something that antedated what we had by probably 60 years or so. It was from New England. It meant the same thing. We found one a little bit later, and all of this made a much better entry. But I thought, our latest quote is 1972, and I really wonder whether people are still using this. So I did a Google search on it and found two examples. One was from the website of Susquehanna University in Pennsylvania. And I thought, oh no, this is a little outside New England.
Doesn't fit the pattern.
Right. But on a university website, you can't tell who's doing the posting. So what I did was to change the regional label from New England to chiefly New England. But the next one really made me disappointed, because it was on the website of a person in Palo Alto, California. And I thought, oh no, this wonderful New England regionalism has jumped to the West Coast. So I didn't want to include it without doing a little more checking. So I emailed the guy whose website it was and said, by chance, do you happen to remember when you learned this word or where you learned it? And within 5 minutes, he got back to me and he said, oh, yeah, I remember that. My girlfriend's from Maine, and she used that, and I didn't know it, and I thought it was such a cool word.
So you didn't have to change the entry after all, then.
That's right. It's still chiefly New England.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hall. This concludes our Linguistic Voices on Campus podcast for today. I hope you enjoyed the program, and perhaps you've learned some new words. I certainly intend to adopt the skeevy. And you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.